and welcome back to the Urbanist Agenda, the podcast that likes to go shopping. I'm joined today with John from Bike Curious once again. Welcome back to the show, John.
Hi, Jason. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah, it's good to see you. I know you were here not too long ago. We were talking about self-driving cars, but this time around, I know we had some good laughs talking about putting traffic cones on the hoods of self-driving cars, but this one made me laugh even more. And so I was like, we got to talk about this. So why don't you tell me what we've been talking about, this event that happened in San Francisco?
Yeah. So in San Francisco, we have a street called Valencia Street. It runs right through the Mission. It's a commercial corridor. It's also in my neighborhood, so it's near and dear to me.
Nice.
And there's a bike lane that runs right down the center of this street. I think it's at this point world famous for how weird it is.
Right. This is one of those center running ones because they didn't want to touch the curbs. And
yeah, exactly.
Funny.
And they did, in fact, though, touch some parking spaces. Apparently, I don't know, 50 or 60 out of the few hundred or whatever it is,
right,
got removed or switched over to loading zones on this street. And some parklets had to be removed. And as a result of this, there's a business owner on Valencia Street that is now engaged in a hunger strike until the city changes something. And it's not even really clear to me, like, what he wants.
I feel really bad because, like, the guy seems to be quite serious and all. But everything I read about this just makes me laugh. Because, I mean, this trope of the, like, business owner angry about bike lanes until they happen and then they love them. It just happens so many times. And I know we were talking. We got, like, a huge list of stories that I don't even think we'll get to them all. But this guy here, he's like, I'll put the link in the show notes, but I want to read this one quote here. He's like, yesterday was an extremely tough day. My stomach really just in extreme pain. Before that, I was doing okay. I'm willing to do it. I really want people to know all my suffering I'm going through. And to be clear, this is because of a center running bike lane on his street.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. And the owner of the restaurant here, Yed, I'm actually not even sure how to pronounce his name. Yed Eltwil? Eltwil.
Yeah, I'm not even going to attempt it.
Yeah, that's the best I can do. He owns two businesses on Valencia Street. And one of them is a restaurant, and it seems to be, you know, somewhat popular. And the other is this business that sells, well, it's kind of a strange business model. I didn't even learn about it until I was reading up on this character. But I guess the story is that his wife inherited the building that the business is in.
Okay.
And they use it to sell basically like t-shirts, stickers, those kinds of things, except for they're targeting Gen Z kids that would otherwise be taggers or graffiti artists. They're like, no, don't deface the city. Instead, buy a t-shirt from our store and you can paint on that or whatever.
All right.
And he's very upset that this business isn't performing well. And I think that he's had to funnel some of the money from the restaurant over to this other business. And he's blaming the city for the parking. It's just an absolutely wild story of someone who is trying to run two businesses that maybe should not run any.
Well, you know, I would have bought one of those t-shirts for sure. But if I saw a bike lane there, there's no way I would have just been like, sorry, I'm out of here.
I mean, how are you supposed to if you can't find parking, right?
Because all of those Gen Zs who are out shopping and they're like, where am I going to put my car? This is a common thing that happens all the time. It's actually just as common as people switching from doing graffiti to buying t-shirts instead.
Yeah. Yeah. And what's really weird, so it sounds like the business owner here on Valencia Street wants to have the parking replaced that was changed into loading zones.
Right.
And he wants his parklets back, which they're still in front of his business. So I don't actually know what's going on there, but maybe the city is pressuring him to take them down. And I think that on a micro level is really weird because he only has like two parking spaces in front of his business and they're both parklets. So I don't understand, like, either he gets the parklets or he gets the parking spaces, but you can't get both. So that's a very strange demand to me. And then on top of all of this is the fact that the Mission here is a very transit-rich neighborhood. It's extremely walkable. It's got like 99 walk score, 99 transit score, and like a very high bike score.
Yeah, it's basically the most walkable area in San Francisco, right?
Yes.
Like, it doesn't really get much more walkable than this and transitable and everything else.
And as a result, like half or maybe a little bit less than half of residents in the area don't even own a car. They're car-free households. And that's not like how many residents are like getting to the store by driving or whatever. This is,
right,
do they own a car or not? Which you can own a car in this neighborhood and also not use it. So I think it really shows how out of touch this business owner is with the local community. And certainly that they're not serving the people who live in the neighborhood if these parking spaces are such a big impact on their business.
Yeah, and I mean, I'd like to hear you talk more about Valencia Street before I go on with my own stories, but this is something that I've seen time and time and time again. It's this typical thing. It's this business owner who's owned a business for a long time. The neighborhood has changed. It's become more walkable. More people are walking, cycling, taking public transit. They haven't acknowledged that this change has happened. They still drive and they're totally out of touch. And I think that's exactly the right way to put it. They're completely out of touch with the neighborhood and their customers and everything else. And I think the thing is, when these business owners do this, I don't think they realize just how stupid they look in the eyes of their customers.
I mean, I hope so. I do hope that their customers are actually locals from the neighborhood, because then maybe there's hope for them. But there is also the possibility that their customers really are just people driving in from the suburbs, and like if they lose a few parking spaces, their business might actually be in jeopardy. And in that case, you know, obviously they shouldn't have a business here. If it's not accessible to their customers, then what's the value in being in San Francisco?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're going to be paying much higher rents for what? Something that supposedly needs a whole bunch of car access. Why not go open in a strip mall in the suburbs?
Yeah, exactly. I think that also another business I wanted to mention on Valencia Street is our local bike shop, the Valencia Cyclery.
This one made me laugh even more. I remember reading about this.
Yeah. So this is an established bike shop. It was like a big part, I think, of the bicycling community here in the Mission. And I think like 4 years ago when the city was evaluating putting in a protected bike lane along Valencia Street, which they still haven't done, we have a center running lane instead. This bike shop came out opposed to installing the protected bike lane because they were worried about the loss of parking spaces. And it's so wild to me because this bike shop, they're just a QBP storefront. You know, if you're in the bike industry, you know what that is. It's the go-to supplier for anything bike related. Almost any bike shop you walk into in North America is going to be stocked almost completely with products from QBP, quality bike parts.
Yep.
And they're trying to make this argument that people are driving in from the North Bay or from the peninsula or all these cities around San Francisco, but not actually customers in San Francisco, to buy the same thing that they could buy at literally any bike shop. I just don't understand what kind of business owner believes that their differentiator is like so strong that they can lure people in from like 50 miles away to come to San Francisco and shop.
It is really interesting to me, because the other thing is, like, you hinted at it a bit here, like, why are you in San Francisco? Like, I think these people also just don't understand the value of their location. Like, their location is valuable because it is accessible by walking, cycling, and public transit. That's what makes that area valuable. That's why the rents are what they are, because I mean, foot traffic is ultimately what drives business at these kind of businesses in a city like this. You know, if you're out in a strip mall or something like that, then yeah, you need to bring people to you. But when you're in a walkable neighborhood, it's all about the foot traffic. And that's literally the most important thing, because a lot of your customers are going to be people who just happen to be walking by or happen to live in the neighborhood. And I think it's just fascinating to me how few business owners understand that benefit even, right? Like, let's even say that, okay, parking is one thing. Maybe they need some parking. I highly doubt it. And we'll get to that in a bit. But they seem to completely not understand the economic benefit of being in a walkable neighborhood. Like, it completely lost on them.
Yeah, it's really wild. Like, there's tons and tons of studies that show the customers that are walking into these businesses are the ones that are spending the most money and coming the most frequently. And if they're driving and they're like, occasional visitors are spending less money. Maybe their one trip is bigger, but they aren't as dedicated of a customer, you know, et cetera, et cetera. There's so much data. And actually, you probably have an article that you want to cite right now, I imagine.
Well, I was actually just thinking that. I was just looking, which one of these multiple articles do I want to cite here? And I'll put some links in the show notes for anybody interested. But I actually know quite a lot about this because I was in Toronto during the time that the Bloor Street bike lanes were being debated, and Danforth Street. Anybody in Toronto would certainly know those streets. And my wife was in advocacy, very tightly involved with Cycle Toronto. We were going to meetings involving city staff. And it was really interesting because I think Toronto actually did an exceptional job at data collection around the Bloor bike lanes. And part of it was because of this pushback from certain business owners. And it certainly wasn't all. There were lots and lots of business owners. And that was the other interesting thing. You know, you look at the news and there were these business owners that were like, this is destroying my business. This is going to destroy everything. And those ones were being amplified by the press for sure, because the majority of business owners were generally in favor of this. But it was really interesting, the polls that they conducted before and after. One of them, for example, this is on Queen Street. There was another one on Queen Street in Toronto. 42% of merchants estimated that more than 25% of their customers usually arrived by car. And so that was really interesting because the actual amount was 4%. They totally underestimate the amount of people that arrive by walking, cycling, and public transit, and totally overestimate the number of people coming by car. And this is very, very consistent. Toronto saw this across the board. They always, always, always massively overestimated the number of people that were coming by car. Very consistent. And I think it's the same thing is happening here in San Francisco.
Yeah. And you know why? I mean, my best guess as to why it happens is, like, these business owners don't live in the city. They don't live in San Francisco. And maybe like generations back, they had roots in San Francisco and they still identify strongly as being like a member of the community and part of the city, but they don't live here. And so their whole experience is driving into the city, trying to find parking, dealing with all of that. And their employees too, their employees are driving in because obviously we have a housing affordability crisis. And so if you're a waiter, you're waiting tables at Yasmin, this restaurant that the guy who's doing the hunger strike owns, then it's pretty unlikely that you are actually going to live in San Francisco. And it's a lot more likely that you have to drive in from some far-flung suburb somewhere.
Yeah.
And so their whole experience is this like agitating, confrontational entrance into the city where they're trying to jam their huge car into like some tiny little hole that's left for them in the city. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that almost isn't even violent enough with language to describe what it means to try and live outside the city and drive into work every day.
Yeah.
But they bring that experience with them to their opinions and to their worldview and just massively skews what it is they think that their customers want.
I think that is exactly right. We saw literally exactly this in Toronto all the time. I remember when we were doing advocacy to install bike lanes on the Danforth, and we actually used to live very close to the Danforth. This is what was known as Greek Town. And there were a lot of the Greek restaurants and Greek specialty shops that were against this. One of the things we consistently saw is that Greek Town used to be Greek Town. It was where all the Greek people were. But over time, the Greek people moved out, especially the small business owners who did very well and then wanted to buy a big expensive home in the suburbs and a big expensive sports car and a big expensive SUV. And this is what they did. They all did this. None of them live in the Danforth anymore, but they did. Originally, they did. And we saw it as well on Bloor, where 49% of business owners drove to their shops while less than 10% of their customers did. And it's exactly that. It's that these people are driving to their shops. They haven't lived there. If they ever lived there at all, they haven't lived there in decades. They haven't seen the changes happen. They have no concept of this. All they know is exactly what you said. All they know is driving into the city, fighting to find parking. That's what they know. And they assume that that experience is universal and applies to their customers as well. And again, it blows my mind that this completely blinds them to the benefit of their location. Like, the location has become more walkable, safer, better transit over the last few decades, and they're totally oblivious to this. But what's interesting is they're totally oblivious to the benefits of this to their business.
Yeah, that is wild, is that they're willing to pay the rent for the walkable neighborhood, but they don't want to preserve, maintain, or even improve on the walkability of the neighborhood.
And it is sad to me because, again, and I want to be really clear here, every time we were doing this in Toronto, the majority of business owners were in favor of these changes. It was always this minority, very, very vocal minority, that was amplified by the press consistently over and over and over. We saw this all the time. But these people, they are shooting themselves in the foot, ultimately. Like, they're sitting on a pot of gold in a location that's just incredible. And they might even own the building. They might have rent protection that gives them very good access to this prime retail location. And they're totally pissing it away.
Yeah. Can't think of anything better to do with their time, I guess. Like, it makes you wonder, the owner of this Yasmin restaurant is actually, it seems, somewhat litigious because he has a history of engaging in legal activity with the city. I think it was like in 2011 or something.
All right. I look forward to his email from his lawyer after this podcast goes out then.
Yeah. I mean, he does have a lawsuit with the city right now over the center running bike lane. And I don't really know what the basis for that lawsuit is, but it's out there.
Right.
And apparently in like 2011, he also filed a lawsuit against the city over some issue. Again, I don't really know what it was, but he's not a stranger to litigating against the city or being frustrated with them.
Right.
And I guess diving in even deeper to this character, he's such a strange individual because I think one of the kind of setbacks that the business Yasmin has faced in the last few years, or I don't know if this was like pre-pandemic or in the depths of the pandemic or what, but there was a fire in Yasmin, the restaurant that this person owns. And the insurance company covered all the damages and it took a while to repair, but the business was closed during that time, but they did eventually reopen. But he was trying to get the insurance company to also pay out his lost revenue so that he could pay himself out of the insurance money. I don't know how typical that is. I know that like I have a small business and I don't think my wages or the money that I get paid is covered by that business insurance that we have. So I don't know if he's just pulling this out of nothing or if this is a real thing, but it was really strange how he approached the problem and talked about it because he ended up being closed for like 3 months due to this issue. And he was blaming the insurance company and all these people around him until eventually the landlord was like, we're going to kick you out of here unless you're paying me rent. And he was like, yeah, okay, well, we'll reopen the business then. And then like it was all over after that. So I don't know. Right. When you're saying like it's just a small fraction or a small minority of these business owners that are engaged in these sort of politics, well, it makes me think like maybe it's the kind of person. Oh, and the reason why the insurance company did not pay out their wages, or at least was delaying on that, was apparently because there was an investigation around arson with that incident. So they thought that maybe he had lit the building on fire. So anyway, it's the kind of person who puts themselves into a situation where they are a suspected arsonist that is also the kind of person that is going to fight against, you know, the removal of a few parking spaces and doing a hunger strike and things like that.
That paints an interesting picture of this character. You know, the story reminds me a lot about this restaurant in downtown Toronto on King Street called Kit Kat. And this doesn't involve a bike lane, but, you know, it does involve anything that's different than cars. So King Street has a streetcar line on it. It's actually the busiest streetcar line in North America. And it would just crawl as it sat through traffic. It was horrific. And so the city wanted to make a streetcar priority street on King Street. And this involved basically just making some intersections that cars couldn't go through. And actually, the final implementation was really, really half-assed. And lots of people ignored the signs and the police had to get involved in everything. But the point is, it did happen. Some parking spaces were removed, including one in front of the Kit Kat. So the Kit Kat is a restaurant on King Street right across from where the Toronto International Film Festival happens. It gets lots and lots of people that come to the theater, but also the film festival is a really, really big deal in Toronto. And so all these people that would come to the theater, there was this row of shops along the south side of King Street that was like the theater row, right? So you go to the theater, you go out to one of the restaurants there, like the Kit Kat, and then right across the street is the theaters. And this is a thing. There's a huge amount of foot traffic that goes by this area. And the guy that runs the Kit Kat was so upset about this streetcar priority project that he just did all these stunts. I mean, I remember he set up a road hockey game on the street to show that it was totally dead. And I was like, that just proves that this street is totally awesome now, dude. But oh my God, King Street became so much better because there were way less car traffic, way more people were out, way more foot traffic. The streetcars were running way better. Everything was better. You could now just cross the street without even like waiting for a light most of the time mid-block. It was all around fantastic, actually. It's great. And I'd like to see them improve the design because it's a little half-assed right now, but it really was great. But the other thing he did, for example, was in the winter, he made an ice sculpture of a middle finger pointing at the street. And it's just so funny to me because I'm like, okay, you're protesting this, but again, you're shooting yourself in the foot because this is bringing more foot traffic right in front of your business in a place that absolutely lives and breathes on the foot traffic. And there's lots of restaurants along this road, too. So the question is, if I'm walking there, I'm going to go to the theater and I'm looking for a restaurant to go to, am I going to go to the one with the giant ice sculpture of the middle finger pointed at me? I mean, I'm probably going to pass that one by, right? And again, I just don't think these people realize how stupid this makes them look in the eyes of their customers who are just walking there, right? The ones who are walking along the sidewalk. The Kit Kat went out of business eventually, not because of the middle finger, believe it or not, but they said because of COVID, because the theaters basically were closed during that time. A few other restaurants did go under, but now that row is back up and fully leased out, and it's great. It's a fantastic area, but I just feel again, like, what are these people doing? Like, do they not realize how dumb this makes them look and how out of touch it makes them look? I think that's the real thing.
Yeah, you know, I really do wonder about that context question, too. Like, if I'm just walking down the street and I see a huge ice sculpture of a middle finger, you know, like, do I even know why it's there? Like, is the average person who's a customer at these businesses aware of the political drama?
Almost certainly not. Almost certainly not.
Yeah. I've been involved in advocacy for almost as long as I've lived in San Francisco. So like I know about which businesses to boycott or which ones you need to show up wearing your helmet. You know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
But I do wonder like the average person who's coming into these stores, like they're just stepping into this like political rat's nest. I feel like the business owner is just going to be like screaming from the soapbox at every customer that walks into the store about these like niche political issues that most people don't really care about.
Yeah. And again, I mean, these people are probably walking there, right? They never had these issues. It's a non-issue to them. Again, back to these stats from Toronto, where they think more than 25% of their customers arrive by car. In reality, it was 4%. Mm-hmm. Like they're just so out of touch that people are just going to be walking up and they're going to be like, I don't know what this is. And if they see these signs, like some of these business owners that I've known have put these signs across their shops that are like, bike lanes are killing us and things like this. And I think just the average person walking along, looking at that, going like, okay, this is a crazy person's shop. I'm just going to go on to the next one.
Yeah. You know, I brought up the signs that, so this business Yasmin and the owner that we've been talking about doing the hunger strike isn't the only business that's kind of organized against this center running bike lane and specifically the removal of parking along, or I should say the reallocation of parking from parking spaces to loading zones, because they're still there. They just have signs up that say you can't use them during certain hours. A whole bunch of businesses hung up this sign in their windows, and I got it right here. So it reads, cyclists, residents, and merchants demand the immediate removal of the deadly center bike lane. Reinstate the historic first bike lane in San Francisco with increased enforcement. That's what their sign says. And that's the second iteration of their sign. The first iteration of their sign was something about killing businesses and stuff like that, which was especially tone deaf because they put up the sign about killing small businesses when a pedestrian had actually died on Valencia Street like the week before. So thankfully they iterated on their message a little bit there. But still, they are kind of ascribing to cyclists that we want to go back to the old bike lane. And like, that's not true. We don't want the old bike lane. That bike lane was way worse than the one that we have now.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, that's probably a controversial take that I just share. But either way, it did address some of the problems that the old bike lane had. So I don't know. It's very strange that they will just kind of broadcast these messages out to whoever will receive them, even if it's not relevant to them. And even if it means jeopardizing customers coming into their store.
I mean, yes, they're shooting themselves in the foot for their own business because they look like they're insane. But the thing is, I think there is this belief, and I get this feeling from some of these people that I've talked to in my years of advocacy. I get this belief that they really do think that everybody thinks this, right? And that they are in the majority and that actually this is being pushed by some cabal of people at City Hall or something, or like these couple of cyclists who have, I don't know, big bicycle behind them. But they really do believe that they are in the majority position and that everybody agrees with them, but maybe they're too afraid to talk about it. Yeah, they're really not.
Yeah, that's very strange. I mean, they're definitely not inquisitive enough to see like, well, how many people do own cars in this neighborhood? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because the data is out there. And if they looked at it, they would be like, oh, maybe I could change my tactic.
Yeah, again, and go back to those stats. Another one of the stats there was that 52% of merchants on Queen Street said that there was not enough car parking, whereas only 19% of visitors said that.
Huh. That's right? Wild.
Like, it's just not as much of an issue, but they don't get it, right? Like, their customers don't really care about that.
Yeah, and we did a transportation study recently here about Valencia Street that was counting the number of people that showed up on foot or driving or whatever, all the different modes. And I think what was wild about it is, I mean, SFMTA, our transit authority here in San Francisco, definitely screwed up the count. Their pedestrian counter system wasn't working correctly. And it was wildly undercounting, but it ended up showing that like 30% of the traffic coming into stores was coming by bike. And then, like, I don't know, it was like 20 or 25% was by foot. And then there was transit. I don't know what the exact numbers were. But even with their like wildly undercounted foot traffic, it was still absurd, like how small a percentage it was that their customers were driving to their stores.
Well, again, I mean, I used to live in the Bay Area. I used to go to San Francisco at least once a week. And I mean, this is not a place that you want to drive to. I would occasionally drive into San Francisco and it sucked. Like, it was definitely not my first choice for going there. And I lived farther down in the Bay Area and owned a car at the time. It's absurd to think that if I want to buy something or if I want to go to a restaurant, I would drive to one of these places in town. I think these people, these business owners, think that their shop has such a draw that people will come from all over, or they're afraid that if people can't come from all over, then they won't have enough customers. But if I'm in the Bay Area and I've got a car, like the majority of people in the Bay Area, I'm not going to drive and fight traffic and fight for parking in San Francisco when I could just go to a strip mall or a shopping mall or a power center, or big box store. Like, there's so many other options available to me that, again, I think these people just really have no concept of the benefits of the location that they have. And they just can't wrap their heads around the idea that if you double down on that, you know, put the bike racks out to make it even easier to park there, make it even prettier outside so that more people want to walk by. They're really missing this in favor of just cramming as many cars in there as possible.
Yeah, truly unhinged. I always am boggled by when people tell me that they drove into the city. I'm always like, doesn't that suck? Isn't that really hard to do? Like, why did you... Yeah, it's very confusing. San Francisco consistently ranks like one of the worst cities to drive in.
I can see that.
Yeah. And yet there's still so many people that do it or insist on it. And like you said, I think it's a vocal minority, but they're really vocal and they're very whiny. They have way too much say.
And it's exactly the same story that I would see in Toronto and other cities too. One of the things that I always noticed in Toronto is that there'd be these business owners would be really, really fighting for these parking spots, right? But when you're talking about a parking spot in front of a business in a walkable area, those businesses are only about one, maybe two cars wide. So when we're talking about parking spaces, we're talking about one or two spaces. And I remember there were some studies done by the city where they went and looked at the parking and see, you know, how often is it turning over and that kind of thing. And people were generally staying there for hours. And what was interesting about it is that the math just didn't work out.
Yeah.
Like, if your business is reliant on those one or two parking spaces, there's just no way. It's a trivial drop in the bucket of the revenue that you need to bring in a typical day for what could come from those one or two parking spaces, because only a handful of people could even use them through the day. But what I do think was interesting, and this has been something I've seen consistently, I even remember Strongtowns talking about this, and I wish I remember the city. I believe it was Minneapolis, but Strongtowns was talking about how there were business owners that were complaining that this parking lot was going to be removed, a surface parking lot, because they were going to put a new building on it. And they were arguing, no, this is absolutely critical for our customers. We need it to be there. Otherwise, we're going to go out of business. And so the city sent someone down to go look at the parking lot, see when it's used, who's using it, how often it turns over, the same kind of things that were done in Toronto. And what they found was that the business owners and their employees were using that parking lot to park. And then they would stay there the entire day and then they would leave. So it was literally only being used by them. So the idea that it was being used by their customers was absurd because it was literally only being used by them. And they were filling up the spaces. So there were no spaces for their customers to park. And we saw exactly the same thing in Toronto, where they looked at who was parking here and it was very often the business owner who would come in, park, or the people who worked there, they'd park, they'd sit there all day using up this supposed parking spot that was critical for their business when really it was just their parking spot.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so glad you brought that up because that is so often the case here in San Francisco too. There's a contested kind of no man's land in the Mission that used to be a rail right of way, like more than 100 years ago or like something like 100 years ago. And now there is no clear owner for this particular parcel. And it happens to be next to like a preschool and like some other businesses and then a residential community. And there's a battle over it because the residents that live in the area know that it's not technically owned by anybody and put in like an urban garden, essentially. And they've been maintaining this now for a couple of years. But the owners of the preschool are at war, essentially, with the gardeners, these urban gardeners, because their employees want to use that space for parking, and they have been able to historically use that space for parking. And now, like, there's sparks flying everywhere. There's allegations of people lying in official hearings, and there's people putting locks on things and cutting locks off of things. And, like, it's just this wild story. And it really boils down to employee parking. Where are my employees going to park during the day? And this isn't a question of revenue or the business's survival. This is about convenience.
Right.
Because remember, we're talking about a neighborhood that is transit rich, walkable, bikeable, one of the least car dependent neighborhoods in all of San Francisco.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of these things that really blackpilled me about all this stuff, is that the amount of lying that goes on is shocking. It was like saying, oh, these parking spaces are critical for our customers, when the reality is they're parking there. So, I mean, maybe they're assuming there's other parking spaces that are being used by their customers, but they're never mentioning that they are using this spot. Like the Kit Kat owner who, you know, the middle finger, they had put up this sign that said no parking in front of his shop, and he used to go and remove the sign. He used to take it or bend it or something. And what he would do then is park his car there. His was the only car that ever parked there, but it was his car that used that spot. And again, it was never mentioned, never when he was talking to the press, never when he was giving his big long speeches, never when he was writing his things online, never did he mention, I need this spot out there. It didn't even occur to him to mention that he used it. It was always, my customers need this, my customers need this. Meanwhile, he's using it.
Yeah. I mean, you're framing it in a very generous way, saying that you don't know why he wouldn't talk about it. But, like, right. It seems pretty clear he's, like, just lying by omission. You know what I mean? Like, he's trying to make it seem like this parking space is for the business's survival, but really the parking space is about his convenience.
Yes. And that really upset me how often that happened. I remember also in Greektown, there was this issue with not enough handicap parking because there were a huge number of cars that had handicap stickers that were parking there and there wasn't enough room for handicap parking. And there was all this discussion around how the street wasn't accessible enough to people with disabilities. And then it was discovered that actually the owners of the business managed to procure a bunch of handicap parking stickers and were using them themselves to park wherever they wanted to on the street.
Yeah, classic.
And again, I'm just like, it made me so upset because we have all these discussions. They become this massive issue that derails good urbanism all the time. And it just comes down to these people just flat out lying.
Yeah. And, you know, that's another kind of question that I am curious about your take on, which is like, why does local government give so much power to these business owners? Like, they don't live here. They don't invest in the community or care about it. Like, why does it matter what they want?
Yeah, I think the thing is, it's just optically, it's difficult to say you've had a business here for 30 years. We don't care about you, right? And again, most of the business owners, in my experience, were in favor of these things. They weren't complete idiots. But again, it was these vocal minority. And certainly in Toronto, it was absolutely the right-wing press that used to amplify them. Like, absolutely, hands down, it was the Toronto Sun, for example, or the National Post, that would write these huge, long articles, front page, we're going out of business. And these people were being amplified. And I think it was just difficult politically to push back against that when, again, you know, you say, I've had a restaurant here for 20 years or whatever, and the city doesn't care about me.
Yeah, that is an interesting point. I think another kind of facet is, like, in San Francisco, it's not the leading source of revenue, but sales tax revenue is a big deal. Right. Like, I think it's number two or number three in sources of revenue. It's like, right, hotel tax, property tax, and then sales taxes, something like that.
Yeah, that's not very common in Canada to do that, to have like a city sales tax. But I know that is quite common in the U.S.
Yeah, yeah. So in the U.S., the sales tax is a pretty substantial portion of the city's revenue. And so it makes sense that the city would think about these business owners as being a representation of how to maximize that revenue. You know, business owner says, my business is suffering because I don't have enough parking. City says, great, I'll build you more parking because I'm going to make more money on it because I trust that you understand who your customers and your clients are.
Right.
And I just think that's just a really naive way to think about revenue. You know, like, if that business can't cut it, they're done, and another business moves in there. That's also sales tax revenue.
Yeah.
So from my perspective, it should be that the city is trying to facilitate commerce. You know, the citizens are the ones spending the money. We're the ones paying for the sales tax, not the business owners.
You would think that they might be just concerned that it would stay vacant or something like that. But again, that's pretty short-sighted. One of the problems that we ran into quite often in Toronto is an organization called Green P, which is the organization that runs the parking spots, gets the revenue from the parking spots, but also the parking lots They're almost all run by Green P, and Green P is an organization owned by the city of Toronto, and the revenue goes into city coffers. So the city is so dependent on the revenue from parking that removing parking spots, every single time it was discussed in city council, the suburban councillors would always come in and say, hey, it's $1.2 million that we're losing here from parking revenue if you get rid of this parking lot or if you get rid of these parking spots. Because again, the city had built itself up to be so dependent on that parking revenue that it then became difficult for them to remove the parking spaces.
Yeah, interesting.
Or at least it was a wedge that the suburban councillors could use to derail any of these good urbanist projects. Again, it's short-sighted. There are different ways of making revenue and making the street more productive and lowering vacancy rates and things like that. There are other ways to make revenue, is my point, as well as just making the city nicer in general. One of the things I actually want to talk about, kind of related to this, and also related to the lying, one of the things I'm very glad that Toronto did was, when they did Bloor Street, was they looked at sales data, but they didn't trust the business owners. And I'm glad they didn't, because there were a bunch of business owners that are like, this is destroying my business. We're totally losing money. But in Toronto and in Ontario, there is one company called Moneris, which runs all of the payment terminals, like the card terminals. And the vast majority of payments were by card. And so they actually went directly to Moneris and they said, we want to get the data, anonymized data, from you for these shops along this. And then they also got it from some control streets as well. And that's also incredibly important. So they were getting real data. Like, this was not being filtered through business owners. This was not from surveys. This is not feels. This was reels, right? And so they got real data from Moneris. And they found, for example, that total customer spending increased on Bloor, but not on the control street. And visitors who would come, what they found was that there was a slight decrease in the average sale, but there was more sales in general. So people were maybe buying slightly less for each visit, but overall, there was a big increase in the amount of revenue coming in. They also did some surveys as well that said visitors reported coming to Bloor 3 days more per month after the bike lane was installed, whereas the control street stayed the same. And the customers who arrived by foot or on bike had higher levels of spending compared to those arriving by car or transit. And this was, again, real data.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought this up because we haven't really talked about it at all. But like, there are dozens of studies that have done this exact same thing.
Oh, yeah. This is super consistent.
Yeah, they all find that revenue along these corridors, on average, goes up. Like, the businesses that are there benefit from it.
I don't think there's ever been a case of a bike lane going in where revenue's been looked at where it hasn't gone up for the bike lane. Like, for example, I know Brent Todarian, who was the former chief planner of Vancouver, posts this stuff all the time on his Twitter and on other platforms as well. And you should probably follow him if you care about such things. But for example, he was talking about Manhattan. He has here, local stores next to the protected bike lane have seen a 49% increase in sales compared to an average of 3% for Manhattan
That's
as a whole.
That's mind-boggling. Like 49%.
49%.
That's a life-changing amount of money.
It literally is to a small business owner. This is the
yeah,
thing that
it really is.
Blows my mind every single time this comes up. And it comes up constantly. Every time there's a bike lane being put into North America, there's some loud minority of business owners who are like screaming from the rooftops that this is going to destroy their business. Whereas every single piece of historical data ever points towards an increase and sometimes a massive increase. Like, can you imagine? Is there literally anything else a small business owner could do that could lead to a 49% increase in sales? Like, literally anything.
You could do something that goes viral on the internet.
Good luck with that.
Yeah.
You can put a middle finger made out of ice and everyone's going to rush over. It just blows my mind. And the thing is, like, the history of this effect goes back so far. And when I was researching for my video on Autoloo, which is actually the second video I ever made on my channel, this is where streets were made mostly car-free and pedestrianized and things like that. There were two major things that came out from the historical stuff. In Groningen, in the Netherlands, they did a traffic circulation plan in the 70s, and local business owners protested. And the politician who was supporting the plan were assigned police protection because they had so many threats of violence from business owners.
Wow.
And now there is no way in hell anybody wants the cars to come back to the center of Groningen. Like, it is a beautiful place and it is the absolute number one retail location in the city. Exactly the same thing happened in Copenhagen. I think it was actually the first pedestrianized street in Europe after well, you know, they were all pedestrianized streets originally, but one that went from cars to pedestrianized, which is the Stroll, I think it's called. But anyway, when the mayor wanted to pedestrianize it, and it was a big deal in the late 1960s, he had to be assigned bodyguards because of death threats from business owners. And again, the center of Copenhagen, the pedestrianized streets in the center of Copenhagen are literally the prime retail in the entire city, hands down. There is no way in hell you would not want to be there if you could. And yet, death threats, literal death threats to the people who wanted to do this. And what is kind of sad to me is that this has been happening since at least the 1960s, but it still happens today, every single time.
Yeah. And, you know, there is no better moment in kind of American or North American cities to make a change right now, because I know San Francisco gets in the press a lot for its downtown and how it's been hollowed out. You know, the revenue's way down and there's way fewer shoppers and all these things. But these are national problems. You know, e-commerce was chipping away at retail businesses for years before the pandemic hit. And then work from home and other macroeconomic factors are making it more and more difficult to be a business owner and to have like the central business district be that revenue driver for a city that it once was.
Yeah.
It's time to reinvent that, you know, and this narrative here, this is an opportunity to actually flip that script. You know, San Francisco is not a quote unquote dead city or whatever. Actually, we're reinventing ourselves around a walkable community that people want to spend time in and spend money in.
Yeah, I get it. When you're a small business owner and you may not be making a whole lot of profit and you're just risk adverse, right? And I think that is the case with a lot of these people. I know we've slagged them off quite a bit. And to be honest, most of them deserve it because they're dickheads. But there are certainly small business owners who will be wary of changes simply because change is scary, right? And when you're already only scraping by and barely paying the rent as it is, it could be scary to think, wow, what if this big change comes and it completely drives me out of business? I get that. But at the same time, all of the data from everywhere any of this has been done ever points towards this being beneficial. And I think you're exactly right. Like in this world of central business districts failing and e-commerce taking over everything, people have to look at this and say, this is the opportunity that I need, right? Like this is something that could really genuinely improve this area. And the businesses that are already entrenched there are the ones that will benefit the most from it. And I think they just need to take that leap of faith. And it's not much of a leap. It's more like a slight step of faith, to be honest, given all the data behind it. They really need to look at this and say, this is an opportunity. And it's just sad to me that we're still having this discussion, to be honest.
Yeah. And, you know, I wanted to point that out, which is like, I feel like the advocacy discussion with these small business owners is kind of stuck in a loop.
Yeah.
And the advocates will focus in on like, no, this is to your benefit. This is the right thing. All these businesses benefit from changes to walkability and bikeability and these things. And the reality is like the data is all about averages, you know, on average revenue increased, you know, 49% on Bloor Street or, you know, whatever street it is in your hometown. But averages don't reflect each individual's experience. And so if I'm a small business owner, there is a chance that my business goes out of business because of it. And it might be that all the businesses around me flourish because of it, but because of who my customer is, that's it. Like I'm done.
Yeah, because you are an auto garage that does oil changes.
Yeah, which actually one of the businesses on Valencia Street is an auto repair shop that is protesting the bike lane.
Yeah, and they are screwed. I mean, I get them protesting the bike lane. A restaurant is 100%. Stupid as hell, but I get it.
100%. And I mean, if we're talking solutions, like I really think that that, again, is an opportunity for advocates. As advocates, we can't just focus on like, no, this is good, because that's not a two-way conversation. That's just telling someone that everything's going to be fine. That doesn't really work. I think advocates need to be advocating for these small businesses that are afraid, you know? They need to be pushing the city to help the businesses through the transition, not by like advocating to not remove parking or not put in bike lanes or things like that, because I'm sure that's the knee-jerk reaction of every business owner. But instead, like, I don't think there's a program in San Francisco that connects these business owners with other business owners who have successfully navigated the change to losing some parking spaces or installation of a bike lane. Just connecting some business owners that have done it successfully, they can say like, look, I can share my experiences with you. And then the other business owner goes like, oh, that's great. I feel less scared now because I can see that it's actually possible. I would love to see advocates actually advocating for business owners.
And I know that a little bit of that happened in Toronto. I know each small neighborhood has a BIA, a Business Improvement Association. And that's typically a group of business owners who all get together and they elect a board and that kind of thing. And we did do some efforts, the advocates did, and the city did, at connecting some of those BIAs together to talk to one another. And that was very helpful. The other thing that happened in Toronto is that there was a campaign to promote some of these shops along an area, especially the ones that were in favor of it. They were giving out stickers that they put on the window to say, like, you know, we're in favor of the bikes. Because again, most of them were. And we would put that up. And then there was a website and some social media that was promoting these businesses and giving them some free exposure and that kind of thing as well. And so then some of them were interested in doing that and putting the sticker up and getting on the webpage of the Cycling Advocates just because that was free exposure that they were getting. And that was very helpful as well.
Yeah. One inspiration for me is like in, I think this might just be a US thing, but I'm not sure. The Small Business Association, SBA. SBA is an organization that I think primarily for businesses provides funding. Like they give you access to more capital as a business owner than you'd ever have access to without an institution like the SBA like backing you.
Right.
And so what you do is you develop a relationship as a business owner, you develop a relationship with the SBA. And after working with them and going through their application process, if I'm only able to get a bank loan of like $10,000, I might actually be able to go to the SBA and after going through this process, get a loan of $100,000, which I can use for capital investments to improve my business and to help me navigate changes like this.
Right.
I would love to see cities putting together a program. Oh, and another part of this is the loans are contingent on you receiving coaching from an SBA approved like business owner.
That's interesting.
And so you get the money, but it's with these strings attached that help you spend the money in a way that's going to help you actually grow your business and ensure that the money gets paid back, which you otherwise wouldn't have access to.
Right.
And so I would love to see cities provide this for business owners. Where's the coaching? Where's the money? How can we help these business owners actually navigate change? Instead of watering down our safety plans and letting more people die, we can focus on maybe we can save these businesses and the people at the same time.
Imagine that. A win-win. Yeah. Is it possible?
Can we not kill people and make money? I don't know.
Oh my God. So I think this is great. And I would like to kind of end on some of these advocacy tips. So if there's anything else that you've got, especially also in what individuals can do if they're seeing this in their own cities, because I guarantee they are, because this is just such a universal thing across North America. I know that I've always encouraged people who are cycling, you got to bring your helmet into the shop with you. Like, I know it's a pain in the ass and you might want to leave it on your bike, but you got to bring it in. You got to bring it into the restaurant and set it down on the table while you're ordering. It's a small thing, but you got to get that visibility out there.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I haven't had the opportunity to do this yet, but I would love to see when a protected bike lane gets installed or when a pedestrian improvement actually gets put in place. A business owner that fought against it or tried to prevent it or delay it, I would love for the bike community to just show up there in force. Everybody wearing their helmets and just throw a party. You know what I mean? Like there's a bar on 17th Street that's been fighting a protected bike lane being installed there for like 2 years, bottom of the hill. I would just throw a party there. Like we got the bike lane, like the bike community loves you now. Everything's fine.
Yeah, that could be fantastic. And I know in Toronto, there were some business owners who were against it and were in the press. And to their credit, they actually went out to the press and did articles saying, I was against it, but you know what? It worked out okay. And I'd like to see that happen more often too.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing.
Yes, it's good to see. Anything else you want to add there? Because that might be just as good a place to end as any.
That's it. That's all I got.
You know, maybe someday the winds will change and business owners will start saying, hey, wait a second. Where's my bike lane? I want a bike lane on my street because look at this. They're doing great over there. Where's ours? And that's what I'm really hoping can happen. I know that that does happen here in the Netherlands sometimes and that improvements are very much welcome and they're fighting over who gets it first. And I would really like to see that happen more often because, look, I know averages are averages, but for the most part, this really does help everybody. And hey, fewer dead people on the road, too. That's always nice, too.
Regardless of whether or not it helps every business owner, it does help every city. And yes, that's really what's important, right?
Yeah. And ultimately, that's really what we need, especially, you know, as you talk, American cities being hollowed out because they've done the central business district idea. And you need to move towards people actually living, working and shopping in the places that they live in the city. And that has to happen more often. Anyway, thanks so much for coming on, John. If you're not familiar with Bike Curious, it's a Twitch channel where he live streams every Sunday, usually from San Francisco. You're very consistent with that, which I appreciate because I'm certainly not with my live streams. So if you'd like to see what it's like to ride a bike in San Francisco and do some fun adventures every Sunday, then check out Bike Curious on Twitch, twitch.tv/BikeCurious. Thanks for coming on, John.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me, Jason.
That's all we have on the agenda for today. I hope you enjoyed listening to it almost as much as we enjoyed making it. I really enjoy talking to other content creators about what they find interesting, and a lot of the people I have on this podcast I met since joining Nebula. Nebula is the subscription streaming service created by and for educational content creators and the people who love their content. Nebula has all sorts of educational content, from videos to podcasts to classes by your favorite creators, as well as Nebula Originals, which are high-budget productions. Honestly, Nebula is such a great platform, and I'm so happy for my content to be available there. If you use our special link, which is nebula.tv/agenda, you'll get a discount off an annual membership, which comes to only $30 a year, which I think is a fantastic deal. So check out Nebula at nebula.tv/agenda and see if there's something of interest to you. At the very least, you'll be able to hear every episode of The Urbanist Agenda a little bit earlier than everyone else, so you can get the inside scoop on what we're plotting and scheming. Thanks again for listening, and maybe next time you'll be listening on Nebula.